You're listening to the Rubbish Trip Podcast. Two no-waste nomads talk trash with people in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
For me, one of the great things about the journey I'm on at the moment is my reconnection to my Māori side. I grew up with te reo Māori as my first language. I was fortunate to go to one of the early kōhanga reo here in Wellington. And then just over the years through college, there weren't the same opportunities to stay within te ao Māori in Wellington alone. There were other challenges that were going on in our family at the time. While I was in the hospitality industry, I wasn't speaking te reo Māori. There were no real opportunities. I certainly didn't seek them out either. At the time, to work with Māori organisations. But now that's completely flipped on its head. Mm-hmm. And it is absolutely what drives me now is to work in the environmental space, but from a tikanga Māori perspective, an ao Māori perspective.
Today we are running our podcast with Tikawa Rob. Tikawa Rob has since 2015 been dedicating his life really to cleaning up our motu, specifically contracting to environmental organisations. Tikawa Rob is really a very busy man. Some of the things he does include working with two trailblazing homegrown organisations, Sustainable Coastlines and Parakore. Sustainable Coastlines focuses on protecting New Zealand's beautiful coastlines and freshwater, home to many endangered species and ecosystems and beloved by the nation. The other, Parakore, which means zero waste in te reo Māori, is supporting marae across New Zealand to transition towards zero waste. Currently, there are roughly about 169 marae signed up to the challenge, and this figure is growing rapidly. As kai arahi for Te Upuka o Te Ika, Tikawa has taken on the role of helping to spread Parakore across the Wellington region. Thank you very much, Tikawa, for agreeing to come on our podcast today.
Kia ora, Hannah. Kia ora, Liam. Lovely to be here. Thank you.
No worries. So I guess we'll start off sort of broad and ask you, I mean, obviously you're doing a lot of work in this area, environmentally focused areas, and we'd be very interested to know what is it personally, professionally or otherwise that has motivated you to do the work that you're currently doing?
Great question. I guess the foundation for this work and for my drive has been my upbringing, so what the experiences that our parents, my sisters and I, gave us when we were young. We would always go out to streams, rivers, lakes, beaches, for at any opportunity really, to go and explore these wonderful places. Coupled with that, being Māori, there's also a really close connection that we have. I mean, it's an intrinsic connection. We whakapapa to the land and the whenua and the oceans around us. So that has guided me as well, I guess you could say.
Cool. And so to be clear, you grew up where?
Grew up on the south coast of Wellington. Born closer to the city, but spent most of my youth in Lyell Bay and then most of my teens in Island Bay.
Wow. So it's a very wild, the Wellington southern coast.
Absolutely. Yeah. I absolutely remember waking up in the mornings, and it could be one of either two scenarios. One was just calm, glistening, mirror-like water in Lyell Bay with the sun rising. We were in Sutherland Road, so looking east. Two other times when, more in Island Bay actually, the house would shake because of the southerly swell that was pounding the coastline. We were up on the cliff just behind the marine laboratory. So, yeah, the two very, very different personalities that would change within the day. And it was always really exciting. Typical Wellingtonian, you have a t-shirt and a storm jacket at the ready all
that's
the time.
So true. That's beautiful. I think there is also something about living close to the sea. I notice it in my own background where I'm from, that really makes you very alive to the sort of fragility of humanity, or that our vulnerability to nature. You know, we can't really, though we have a massive impact on the oceans, at the end, the oceans have a massive, you know, impact on us and control.
Absolutely, yeah. On a literal level, we were perched on the edge of a cliff. But being exposed to that ocean meant that we were sort of, we grew up knowing our vulnerability and our dependence on the weather, to which guided our lives, whether we'd actually go outside that day or not. Mm. And it also meant that weather and the climate impacted whether we were able to get kaimoana. This was in the days before there was a marine reserve in Island Bay, and there was a rickety old path that we used to walk down. Dad would walk down, and sometimes us kids would go with him. And we would go out and get a crayfish and a parwa, and that would be dinner for the night, you know, for us, which was quite a luxury these days.
Yeah.
But if the weather had been stormy, then there was no kaimoana for us. So, yeah, that dependence on the marine environment and the coastal environment guided our lives, absolutely.
Mm. I'd be quite interested to know if over time you noticed changes, and perhaps that was something that got you interested in the work that you're doing now.
Definitely. I think of a story of when we were growing up in Island Bay. My sisters and I used to go to this particular area. It was to the west of the island, so right in front of the marine laboratory, and it was called the tropics because it was quite shallow, and there was a little bit of a reef further out, so it protected us from the bigger swells, and we used to just go snorkeling, and we would see these little parwa sort of just growing up in a sort of a nursery environment. And as it got closer to the marine reserve being put in, we stopped seeing those little parwa. And Dad also noticed that he stopped seeing crayfish. There was almost no parwa further out. And what that sort of indicated to us was there was this huge amount of poaching happening, and this marine reserve couldn't come soon enough. So while now we can't go and harvest food, collect food in the same way that we used to, it means that there's spillover. And that really changed the environment of Island Bay, for the better, in my opinion, even though it was quite tense at times.
When they were setting up the marine reserve, you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a huge amount of public consultation, and there were definitely people in both camps, really staunchly in both camps, for and against. Mm. Even with our family, my dad was opposed to it in principle, because it meant that we couldn't get kaimoana, and he wouldn't have the opportunity to take his future grandkids down there to go fishing in the same way that he did for us. But at the same time, we also recognised that the coastline was just getting absolutely plundered.
Mm.
So it needed to go in there, just because it was just completely unregulated. There weren't enough fisheries officers out there. And it's now fantastic. It's absolutely stunning. I go snorkeling there every now and again, and see just crayfish. They're massive, and it's so good. Mm. The marine life, the diversity is just beautiful. Because it is sort of fairly vulnerable coastline, and there are still pressures on that coastline, the impact of land uses is still very prevalent out there, particularly if you're looking at Orfordville Bay and the waterways that's coming down there.
Through the landfill?
Yeah, through the landfill. There's some pretty poisonous stuff coming down from one of the commercial construction and demolition landfills has been polluting one of the fresh waterways up there, and that's having an impact on the marine environment for sure.
Yeah, which again brings us back to this idea of waste. It's actually not just plastic waste in the ocean, but also the impact of what we're putting in Papatuanuku. Well, you're obviously doing a lot in the environmental contracting work now, but you haven't always been so intensely involved, because you were doing other things before that, is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. When I, despite all this in connection to the environment, I guess in some ways, when I look back, I think that was normalised for us kids. We were always connected to the environment, so we could do whatever we wanted and have that connection. I guess what that meant was when I left college and got into the workforce, I ended up in hospitality, which was amazing. It was wonderful. I mean, people are my passion. Underneath it all, people are my passion. I love talking to people and connecting with people. So hospitality was really great place for that. And for many years, just I guess worked in the industry, and went from, you know, wiping tables and cleaning dishes to being general manager of a international coffee company. So I got to see a lot. But fairly recently, I sort of made a realization that actually a lot of the work I was doing was actually in conflict with my values.
And so from that point, is that when you sort of started taking on more of this sort of work with sustainable coastlines and etc.?
Yeah, definitely. I've known Sam Judd, who's the founder of Sustainable Coastlines. We met in college. He's a year or two younger than me. So I've always been aware of Sustainable Coastlines and the work that they've been, the fantastic work that they've been doing. And in 2012, I got an opportunity to co-manage the delivery of the Love Your Coast education roadshow in Wellington. And since then, my sort of involvement has been a bit more formal. I would volunteer often, but it wasn't until end of 2015 when I walked away from the hospitality industry, particularly the coffee industry, and threw everything to getting back to my values and working in this space. And Sustainable Coastlines has been was pivotal in helping that transition by involving me in work and workshops, in opportunities to grow my skills. And I guess they recognised that I had that fundamental passion for the environment, so really keen to get me on board, and it's, I'm thrilled that, to have had that opportunity then, and to still have the opportunity now to work for Sustainable Coastlines.
And so what is it about Sustainable Coastlines that particularly, apart from obviously the tautoko they've given you, the development and that kind of stuff, what is it so inspiring about that organisation?
Many things. I guess really it's founded with people first. I mean, understanding that a lot of the challenges that we have in the marine environment, particularly just in reference to the coastline aspect, it's people that we need to support to find the solutions. So again, it enabled me to follow my passion of working with people, but in a way that wasn't this is how you need to do it, more what are some solutions that you can do in your world, in your environment, in your lifestyle that can contribute to this overall good work. Working with kids is immensely rewarding as well. I mean, you know, there've certainly been times when I've been feeling a little bit flat, and have gone into a school environment to deliver an education program, and you're met with, you know, 30 high energy, borderline screaming children who are just absolutely frothing about getting to talk about turtles or whatever
great.
Is important to them.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, and that just brings me up and it brings everyone up. And so there's this amazing energy when you walk into the room and kids are like, ah, this is so cool. We're so good. And we're going to the beach afterwards. You know, it's choice. I mean, I've lost count the number of times that you have high fives with kids afterwards and they're like, oh, thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Sir, well, who's that? I don't
know. Yeah.
My dad's not here. You know? Who are you talking to?
We've certainly noticed, because we also go into schools and do presentations, and we've just noticed how onto it the kids are. I mean, maybe we just had, I don't know, maybe we had low expectations. I don't think we did. I think it's just that they're so knowledgeable. And not just, you know, general things, but quite specific facts. You know, all of them know about the Ilfeto stream that's running through the landfill. A lot of them, you know quite detailed things about following the waste hierarchy, that refusing, reducing and reusing is more important than recycling and all this kind of stuff. It's quite impressive.
It's amazing. And yeah, the kids have this amazing unfiltered view of the world. You know, it is a really pure perspective on things. And it's not hard for these amazing young minds, these incredibly creative developing minds, to make these connections. And yes, the real sort of questions is what happens after they leave school that makes it harder to make these connections? What is it? So I'm curious, I'm personally curious about that, what we can do to sort of change that diminishment of energy, or maybe it's practice. I don't know. Maybe just not in that practice of making these connections so well in our lives, or we're influenced by other things too often that we forget. So yeah, it is really refreshing to go into a school environment and hear these wonderful ideas.
That's so sweet. There is actually, it was one thing I wanted to pick up on what you were saying before about your decision to go into hospo, and then what you basically just said right now. So just to go back to that, was you mentioned that despite the fact that you'd grown up with super like awareness of the environment and all that kind of stuff, you went into hospo. Maybe, I just wonder if it's partly this thing of, if something is so obvious that we should protect and have stewardship for the environment, that perhaps we just presume that the systems in place are going to respect that, coupled with the fact that it seems that a lot of, for example, our waste problems are sort of hidden from us.
Yeah.
What is it about the systems that don't sit with what is so obvious to children or so obvious to, you know, from an environmental perspective?
A very deep question, really. Mm. I mean, it's and I think if we can crack that with everyone, problem solved. You know,
environmental utopia.
It is. It's a great question, and I mean, I only really feel comfortable reflecting back on my personal experiences rather than speak for everyone generally. But certainly, when I got into the workforce, the employment factor meant I felt enabled to do things. I could have decisions because I was able to earn money. But that quickly sort of then became a bit of a trap in a lot of ways. Mm. Okay, cool. Well, I can move out of this dingy, damp flat and move into a slightly better one. And okay, well, I need to earn a little bit more money to be able to afford that. So da da da. And there's this sort of creeping, I guess. There's a creep up of everything that comes with that. Not only do you can earn a little bit more and you can live in a better place and you need more heat to warm it, that you need all these sorts of things. And that generates demand on resources. And the impact that we then have on the environment creeps up with those opportunities, I guess you could say, that come with employment if you're chasing the dollar. And I mean, I'm an ambitious person and I consider myself quite motivated, so I was striving to achieve things, and with achieving certain things there was a financial benefit that came with it. I wasn't chasing the dollar so much, I was chasing new skills or responsibilities and experiences, but the reward for that was there's a little bit of a pay rise, there's, you know, you get a company phone or whatever. And I think that people can sometimes look to those things as the measure of your progression and development rather than the skills that you're learning. So certainly I felt on reflection now that some of those things have started to influence me in a way that started becoming counterintuitive to, you know, was impacting against my values without really realizing it consciously. So
that's interesting.
And while I had opportunities to have an influence over some of the decisions that we were making around the products that we would use, coffee cups, for example, where they came from, the environmental impact of those coffee cups, were they, you know, standard plastic oil based or were they fully compostable, I was never fully in a position to make that final decision, to have my say and have my influence, but there were other people who would have that final decision. So yeah, I guess coupled with that, it sort of felt like, okay, well, it's not really, I can't really make that much of an impact here, so I'm going to step out from within that environment and work with my sleeves rolled up, actually doing other things to engage people.
Do you think also what you mentioned about that sort of incremental kind of, you're working towards something and you're getting the pay rise and the next thing and whatever, do you think that also makes us unaware of how our footprint might be changing, you know, because they are incremental changes?
Yeah, it's a funny one. I hadn't really actually reflected on the creeping, as I've just called it, just now, until this conversation. And I think our perspective on that incremental movement of direction has become skewed. You know, I was working towards becoming a manager and having a team and be able to facilitate their upskilling and motivating them to be really cool managers and leadership skills and things like that. And with that came those benefits. And those benefits, while they looked positive on one hand, they were completely degrading on the other hand. So maybe is it time to start looking at those creepings in a different perspective? The actual creep you're making is the positive impact on the environment rather than the other way around, the negative impact on the environment.
Yeah.
That's a really good point.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
I don't know, just throw that out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had also one question about, because it's again, I'm seeing this, what you're saying about hospitality and the changes that need to happen there, but then also talking about sustainable coastlines. What I would be interested in knowing is, from your work with sustainable coastlines and from your experience working in hospitality, do you have any particular view on the argument that we can tell individuals to change their behaviour, let's say with waste, as much as they want, but actually it's business's responsibility? Or do you think it's a bit of both? Or do you think it's predominantly consumers that drive businesses to provide these kind of options? Do you have a view on that?
Yes, I do, yeah. And multiple views. I guess it's an incorporation of all of those things. The traditional model of business is to respond to consumer needs. So where the dollars are being spent, they start responding to that. I think back to, only 5, maybe 10 years ago, when some organic chicken at a supermarket would be, you know, just get a mortgage to buy it. But these days, that's quite normalised. In some supermarkets, almost seems like there's 50-50 of, you know, free-range organic chicken next to kind of dirty chicken, you know. So they're responding. I think also it does take business to take the lead and show leadership. And that doesn't necessarily need to be driven by the financial aspect. It can also be driven by the social aspect. A couple of supermarkets have come out now saying they've completely banned microbeads from their product, from their shelves. And that's well in advance of government's implementation of that mandate, I believe it is, or policy to stop microbeads coming into New Zealand. So they're responding to social indicators. You know, what are consumers wanting to associate themselves with on social media? And but absolutely, as individuals, we have the ultimate responsibility, I think, as well. The power is with us to influence that change. And I think the really important aspect of that is to become a collective again. There's too often I hear stories about people feeling isolated and yes, okay, right, so I can go and clean up the beach in my own time, and I can, you know, not buy that product or buy this product or grow this at home and not do that or take this action. But having a real sense of isolation about it, that they're sort of on their own island. And it's really reassuring to go to events, public cleanups and things like that, where people can then come together and actually say, this is cool, I came to this public cleanup, this is great, but I'm really reassured to meet a whole bunch of other people from this community who also do this, who I'd never crossed paths with because they walk their dog at a different time to me and I don't get to see them. That bringing back that community aspect, I think is huge, hugely important to us shifting the being part of that change.
I think that's really true. And actually, one thing that people often will bring up with Liam and I when we're talking about zero waste is this idea that having these kind of lifestyles is actually only a lifestyle that's accessible to perhaps more well-off people or that kind of thing. It is quite contrary to our experience of living zero waste, because we've saved a lot of money, and it's actually required us to be more connected with our communities in order to have access to resources that we may need. But I'm wondering, do you have any thoughts on that in terms of the work that you've been doing about whether it is... I mean, I think there's a real worry that environmental individual actions get too associated with wealth or privilege or whatever, and how that, you know, caring about the environment can be taken back, I guess, as a sort of democratic expression. Or
from my perspective, I think being able to take ownership of our actions is an affirmation of our sovereignty. And being Māori, tino rangatiratanga, and sovereignty, it's the same thing. It is the same topic. So for us to be able to exercise our sovereignty, and I speak from a Māori perspective, to us to be able to exercise that is for us to be able to look after the environment in the ways that we want to. It's not a requirement by any other organisation. It is that independence, is that ability to be in control of the food that we put on the table, to be in control of our impact on the environment. And it springs to a lot of things. There are new terms for this: food sovereignty, affirmative action, you know, that is all tino rangatiratanga to us. So in a lot of ways that's normal for us, us as Māori.
We're really interested in how you came to learn about Parakore and also how you feel about that organisation as a Māori organisation and working with marae around Aotearoa. What are the challenges and opportunities faced that are sort of different, I guess, from a Māori perspective than, I don't know, Pākehā perspective?
Well, I first came into contact with Parakore through connections at Sustainable Coastlines. This would have been probably about 2 years ago, so only relatively new on my radar. But immediately I became very aware that it was a Māori organisation, founded in Tikanga Māori, by Māori for Māori. So that was really awesome for me from the outset. I then was given an opportunity to present at last year's Huiato 2016 up in Parihaka, and got the opportunity to meet with Jackie and the team at Parakore and further understand, get a clearer picture of what Parakore was doing and the foundations and history of Parakore. What's the second question?
Yeah.
The particular challenges faced by marae?
It's a complex one in a lot of ways because, for starters, some of the challenges that marae have are simply just getting people back to the marae. So there are marae that are heavily used often, and they tend to be closer to urban environments or closer to environments where there's a really strong iwi presence. I think back to Ngāti Awa, where I'm from, in Whakatane, and Mātātua marae gets used all the time now that it's come back to us. Well, there are other marae that are more rural that don't get used that often. So if there are people there often, then there are opportunities to have conversations about waste minimisation because you can make that a regular thing. Where a marae is not used so often, there can be unique challenges because there might not be the same infrastructure there. There might not be the same equipment, cooking equipment, fridges, those sorts of things there. So I guess our approach to working with marae is we don't bring in a template at all. We bring in our knowledge and foundations of tikanga and kaupapa Māori, but we work with every marae to work towards zero waste. I mean, that is ultimately our goal, working towards zero waste. When we get there, if it is possible for every single marae to get there, is further down the track, but something we absolutely aspire to. But the immediate goal is getting marae working towards, and that's the key. That's the key message. Okay, cool. Maybe you don't use plastic bags. Maybe you take your own boxes. You've got cardboard boxes that you brought in last time. There was a fruit delivery or a meat delivery. You're out taking those to the supermarket to get these things. Okay, cool. So you got some land. Well, could we support you to grow a mata, have a worm farm, have composting on site? Could your compost heap be the collection point for the local kura and koangareo? And then we start talking about those. Then we start looking at the whole community picture, not just simply what the marae is. The marae, for us, and has always been, is a hub for the community. And especially, even recently, not just in Te Ao Māori or in the Māori world, it's a hub for the community. When there are earthquakes in Christchurch, where do people go? They went to marae. Earthquakes in Kaikoura, where do people go? Marae. Same in Edgecombe. When the floods came through, where do people go? Marae. That's where... That's where people collect and that they congregate. That's where the hub is. That's where people can feel reassured. So there is a place that people can be introduced to those concepts of waste minimisation and zero waste outside of simply with Māori whānau.
Yeah, and that really goes back to the point you're saying before about kind of collective action, and that we can often feel so isolated in our lifestyles, and like we were saying, we sort of, we target our zero waste message at least at households and individuals, but even then, often I still feel like I'm isolated. I go to the supermarket and everyone else around me is just not really bothered about the kind of waste, but yeah, so having marae is kind of another space for that kind of collective action.
Absolutely. I think back to when I came to your presentation here in Kelburn. Half the people in the room, if not more potentially, were already doing a lot of these fantastic practices, but the opportunity for them was to connect with each other,
yeah,
and give each other high fives and support each other, yeah. You know, that's the other part, you know, part of them come along to learn new things, but the big part is just about that sort of coming together of community again,
yeah.
And going, oh great, cool, you're doing this, oh you've got that, you've got a beehive, no way, oh, awesome,
yeah,
and
yeah.
Connecting those things, because you know, just like in your presentation, need a hole in a wall, not a drill.
Yeah.
You know, if someone's got something over here, then you know, that coming together of community helps to build that community resilience.
Yeah, for sure. I think that seems to us to be one real opportunity that marae present. There's still quite a strong community space from which to try these ideas, which, yeah, occur across society, but it is a particularly interesting case study. I guess the other question about parakore is what you feel is particularly offered by Maturanga Māori and Tau Māori in terms of helping us to think about waste or, you know, environmental stewardship generally. Like, what is distinct or unique that particularly guides your mahi in that area?
Mm. I think for starters, whenever we're approaching an organisation, because we are a Māori organisation, the door's open. I mean, not to say that the door wouldn't be open otherwise, but you know, there's a lot more trust established there. So that means that when we can bring in what we've learned and our knowledge over time, in the recent time, our more modern world, of the impact of waste, the ears are more open and can understand that. When incorporating Mātauranga Māori and our Māori worldview, you know, for us it is whakapapa. It comes back to our physical connection to the world around us. And in similar ways to the old school awareness of or description of conservation, where people were separated from the things that need to be protected, that didn't work so well, because I mean, sure, if you've got a black robin and there's only one left, then you need to put that in a cage for a wee while until you can get a second. You know, sure, I get that. But simply putting a fence around a place and saying, no people can come in here, we've got to preserve this as an island, people disassociate with that.
Yeah.
You can't connect with that anymore. So our conversations and all our mahi, all our framework is built around our whakapapa to the world around us. And I can't, because my mātauranga isn't as deep as others, but I certainly know people who can trace their physical being on earth back to the gods.
Mm.
You know, there are a few people out there who can do that. They can trace their whakapapa, their genealogy. And when you do that, you can then jump from human relationships to the environmental relationships, and that's where the connections are. When we all descend from our gods, well, we were the last to be created. Everything else came before us. Birds, stones, mountains, you know, trees, everything was here before us, so we are the children of them, and so we need to respect that, and incorporating that into our work is crucial. It's fundamental.
Yeah, that's really, really profound. I mean, we certainly noticed when we were at the Parihaka Wananga as well, just the ease with which you can talk about, like just specifically because we were there for the waste thing, the ease with which you can talk about why it's important. And also, you know, like there's the concept of the circular economy, which is, you know, popular around the world. But actually, it's so well communicated with, you know, Maturanga Māori as well, with different concepts, but it's very similar. I found that particularly profound and useful as well.
As did I. I mean, one of the really great things about one of the great things about the journey I'm on at the moment is my reconnection to my Māori side. I grew up with te reo Māori as my first language. I was fortunate to go to one of the early kohanga reo here in Wellington, And then just over the years through college, there weren't the same opportunities to stay within Te Ao Māori in Wellington alone. There were other challenges that were going on in our family at the time. So for me, the other really key aspect of coming back to this work, for me, I say coming back because it's kind of, I feel like that's where I started my life, has been about regaining my identity. And while I was in the hospitality industry, I wasn't speaking Te Reo Māori. There were no real opportunities. I certainly didn't seek them out either at the time to work with Māori organisations. But now that's completely flipped on its head. Mm. And that is absolutely what drives me now is to work in the environmental space, but from a tikanga Māori perspective, an Ao Māori perspective, working with Māori to support other people who might be like me, who have maybe become a little bit more disconnected, but just need someone else who they can hopefully relate to reconnect again.
One thing, I mean, we obviously are very, very supportive of Parakore, and we are hoping that our crowdfund will exceed its target so that we can give the extra proceeds to Parakore. And I think one of the things that is important to us, I mean, we're both Pākehā, but can see how enriched we all can be from engaging with Te Ao Māori and understanding different concepts, in part to broaden our own understanding of what is possible and ways of seeing the world, but also to help us go back to our own spaces and reflect on how those may be subjective rather than objective. I think one of the things that I was thinking about recently, you know, the granting of personhood to the Whanganui River and to Urewera, I think some people got very confused about that in the Pākehā world, thinking it was a bit strange to personify, you know, an environmental thing. But actually, in the Pākehā world, for a very long time, we've given personhood to companies. And how is that, you know, when you think Brilliant. About that, it's Brilliant. Like, well, that's very a bizarre, you know, that's no more, you know, strange, oh, sorry, normal or whatever, you know, however you want to frame it.
Yeah. Mm.
So we all, every culture has these frameworks that we use and these things that we've absorbed. And the way that Parakore communicates these ideas is really, really wonderful. And I mean, there's lots of resources online as well for anyone that wants to go and look at and understand in more depth. So, yeah, we really tōtoko what you guys are doing.
Well, thank you. And we're absolutely grateful and generous for your generosity to us and your support of us. To normalise these conversations, to enable people to relate to these concepts, to our way of living, our way of seeing the world, in a more mainstream audience, to a more mainstream audience, I guess you could say.
We sort of wanted to end on an interesting question, which could go in a couple of ways, but we'll see. What is your perspective on the future in terms of, you know, in the space of environmental issues, you know, in so many ways we have environmental disasters looming in so many areas, climate change and waste issues and blah blah blah. But in terms of the progress that's being made in different areas, and maybe specifically to Aotearoa, but around the world, what is your perspective on the future of the environment?
Awesome question. Well, as an optimist, I am hopeful. I am absolutely hopeful. I mean, it would be very easy to start to focus too much on the problems and the challenges and become really depressed. I wouldn't be surprised if rates of depression amongst environmental scientists are probably, you know, high, disproportionately high. But aside from that slightly negative perspective, I have hope. Last night, Parakore, we were at the Green Ribbon Awards, which is the awards held by Ministry of Environment. We were one of the finalists last night.
Oh, congrats! I didn't even know that. Thank you. That's amazing.
Yeah. We unfortunately didn't win, but that's okay. We learned last night that most winners are there for 4 or 5 years before they actually win. So,
wow.
So 1 year down.
Oh, kapai.
So fingers crossed.
Yeah.
But one of the great things that came out of that was actually seeing the number of Māori-led iwi-led and or Māori-led projects that were being awarded.
Mm.
I think it was almost a third. Mm. It was like a third of the projects that were happening out there were Māori-led. So I'm really optimistic that people are now able to engage with the environment in greater ways than they have been able to before. There are more apps that are coming out. If apps are your thing and that's what gets you outside, then awesome, that's great. Okay, cool. Anecdotal sort of evidence through friends has said that through Sustainable Coastlines, back when we were approaching schools initially to run education programs in the schools, the teachers were like, oh, okay, sure, yeah, send me an email, we'll think about it, we'll come back to you, da da da. These days they're now, yep, sure, great, absolutely.
Yeah.
And if anything, the challenge now is for teachers now is how many external organizations focused on the environment can they get in? There seems to be, we're one of many who are in some ways vying for 1 hour, 2 hours of a class's time. So I'm also thinking too, some of the things that I'm learning in Kura Kaupapa Māori with another organization I'm doing work with, these young people are doing work that I couldn't even dream of doing as an adult. They're out there already doing these fantastic things. Wow. So I am hopeful. I really am hopeful. And despite the fact that there are some really, the urgency of needing to make massive changes is not going away. It's increasing. I am really hopeful that we can get to that point and make these changes before we've tipped too far. We've all acknowledged that there is going to be impact. There is going to be things that we are going to face climate issues, but we still have time to be able to make positive changes so that we and the world around us and everything that's many of the things that are around us, we can still survive.
Yeah. And like you say, it feels like there is an urgency in the response too, you know, and we've noticed that gearing up for our trip, that like it just seems to be a really people are far more concerned and interested in waste issues
than they were two years ago
when we started Living Zero Waste. So we're also hopeful there's kind of this matching the urgency of the problems with an urgency of finding the solutions and taking action.
And you have to. I mean, I don't want to go, I don't want to see my last days out thinking, man, I could have done more. I'm going to do everything I can. It's because the existence of my grandchildren depends on it.
Yeah.
And everyone's grandchildren, not just my grandchildren, but your grandchildren. Mm. You know, that's the responsibility we all have.
Yeah.
I think that's a beautiful way to end. Yeah. So thank you so much for talking with us today, Te Kawa.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.